drop a line and catch some fresh fish. It's more of Go Fish with Mike Buck.
And the segment of the program is brought to you by our friends at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. As you know, by the way, we've got a Fishers Forum coming up real soon. And you, of course, are invited. We hope you are able to participate. And participating today, as you know, the council reaches out and does a lot of things with a lot of people. And we've learned more and more what sort of their mission is, and what most of what they do is plan to evaluate how the fishery's doing. And to that point, we have joining us today Jeff Polavina. He's a chief ecosystem at the Pacific Islands Science Fisheries Science Center, which is a big mouthful. But you're going to learn today that we're doing things there that are providing us with a lot of guidance. And what we're talking about is the ecosystem and the fisheries. And I know that's a pretty broad stroke of the brush. But, Jeff, before we get into what you do, let's find out a little bit about you. Where was your initial interest in this? Where did you start cultivating this scientific interest?
Well, I've always been interested in the ocean, mm-hmm. and being able to look at how fish and the whole ecosystem works has been a real intrigue.
Where did you grow up? Where's home?
Well, I grew up on the East Coast, mm-hmm. and kept moving westward. Mm-hmm. I did my graduate work at Berkeley and came out and sailed around the Pacific, all across the Pacific, and happened to stop in Hawaii in the mid-70s.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history. I said, hey, this is a really nice place.
Yeah. You know, interestingly enough, now that we're looking backwards, both in Hawaii and other parts of the world, a lot of these older civilizations or previous generations, they were pretty responsible. I mean, you know, they had some pretty good science and some pretty good ideas. Are you fascinated by that as I am?
Well, certainly the Hawaiians had the Apu'a'a mm-hmm. concept where they linked land and the ocean, and they took an ecosystem perspective.
What are your aspirations now as to the work that you're doing? First of all, let us know a little bit more about the Science Center. What is the structure there? What's it about?
Well, there's a number of divisions of mm-hmm. research divisions there. There's a coral reef division. There's a fisheries division. I run the ecosystems and oceanography division, which takes a broad look at all parts of the ecosystem mm-hmm. from the physical basis all the way up to the apex species. Mm-hmm. We do things like putting tags on tunas and sharks and turtles and looking at how they're using the ocean. We use satellite data to understand ocean features, fronts and eddies, and how those create habitat.
Yeah. But what I was interested to find out is, when you said the apex, mm-hmm. that a lot of the studies before were done on those.
Exactly.
And from what I understand now, you're looking at a broader spectrum of species. To what avail? I mean, why is that going to be
valuable?
Well,
that's absolutely right, Mike. Traditionally, people have focused on the management by looking at what's being taken, the target species and the fishing effort
whatever.
For food. Mm-hmm. But now, the ecosystem will change for many reasons, changing habitat, changing productivity at the base of the food web, changes in the middle of the food web, the prey that the animals eat can change due to ocean mm-hmm. conditions. So what we're trying to do is provide a broad look at how the ecosystem is changing to provide guidance to managers that give them a bigger picture of how the ecosystem's responding.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if sometimes, and I know the way it boils down here in Hawaii is pretty simple. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But what I think is fascinating is the attention being paid now. I have, for instance, the skippers and some of the guys from that Wicked Tuna, reality show on, mm-hmm. and you know how tightly monitored for bluefin mm-hmm. the eastern seaboard is. Right. And then what about people like yourself that saw the decimation of sharks? I mean, you mm-hmm. Up until very recently, I mean, shark fin soup was like on every street corner in some parts of the world.
Yeah. No, and sharks are a big part of the ecosystem, mm-hmm. and they're very vulnerable. So, you know, monitoring shark catch rates in the fishery is an indicator of vulnerable species, and you want to maintain a certain
We know sometimes, Jeff, that the economics of scale dictate what you can and can't do, mm-hmm. how many staff members you have doing this and that. And I would imagine in the very beginning, in the research that you and others have been doing, was based on, okay, here's how much we have and here's what we can look at. Are we becoming more alarmed to look at the bigger picture now, that we better look at, like, okay, we're talking about tuna, but we didn't pay any attention to what they eat. Now we're finding out that we're taking what they eat, so they can't grow anymore. Right. I mean, you know, it's a darned if you do, darned if you don't.
Right. So, I mean, the good thing, the budgets haven't been increasing, but the good thing is the tools have been getting better. I mean, when I started, we had so limited ability to look at anything other than the catch of the target species. And now we have all sorts of tools, from satellites to tags to various ways of sampling trawls and looking at genetics.
I'm fascinated by the other day we had a couple of guys in, we're talking about doing food surveys with GoPro cameras and grids.
Right.
And I mean, you guys are all involved in some of this neat technology now.
Yeah, and then there's some basic technology. One of the things that we're doing for the pelagic fishery is we have this sampling program of the diets of lancet fish. Mm-hmm. And lancet fish are provided to us by the observers on the longline fishery, and they have this ability to maintain the prey in them very well preserved.
Amazing.
So we can go back 25 years, because there's earlier Japanese work, and we can see how the prey of a lot of these pelagic animals has or has not changed over time.
Well, you'll know that in the community here in Hawaii, that the biggest secret is what lure and what color did you use?
Sure.
You know, because there's some magic, you know, when you learn that fish are a little bit more colorblind than we thought and some other things. But it's the fisherman who the lure has to appeal to. But every now and again, when you're out trolling, you talk about a pelagic, you catch a mai mai and throw them on the deck, and out comes some ikai. You think, well, that's pink. Let's use a pink lure. Yeah. There's science to that.
Sure. Yeah. And the combination of prey is really, I think, important to how the energy moves up the food web. If there's more jellyfish and fewer ika, then there's less energy going to the top of the food web.
What would suggest to support this? Because I want to liken it to like somebody that's at a buffet line, you know, with a plate, and you're hungry, you're picking the stuff that you really want to eat. Do fish have that choice, do you think, or are they likely to just say, hey, I don't care what it is, I got to eat?
Yeah, well, we see that the diets of fish seem to be persistent for quite a long time, so they're pretty... Part of it is what's
there may be a little picky of what they can, available.
Part of it is what they catch. Part of it is, I think, that the caloric value of the organisms they're eating, and but I think if they're presented with a variety of prey of the size they can eat, they're probably going to take it.
I know little kids are fascinated when you talk about things like whales and what do they eat. They think that they eat aku or marlin or something because they're big. Yeah. But isn't it also fascinating that some of the things you eat, you study, eat things that are about the same size as they are. I mean, look at voraciously like an onu, what he'll try to eat.
Sure, right. So, I mean, typically a lot of fish tend to eat something about the weighs about 1/100th of their mass.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you do find these exceptions, like these, you know, 3-foot, 4-foot lancet fish will have a juvenile lancet fish that's 2 feet long in their stomach or a big, you know, plastic bag or something.
Those that don't know what you're talking about when you talk about lancet, what are they?
Well, there's a long, skinny fish that's caught in the longline fishery. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's the most abundant catch in the longline fishery, but it has no commercial value, so it's typically discarded.
So it's bycatch and it's
discarded. Bycatch and it's discarded.
Have they anybody looked into making it have value? Why do they have no value? Just their
construction? The flesh is fairly watery and they just sort of fall off the line mostly, but they're great predators out there, and they give us a great way to measure the diet.
So when you say you do that, typically on a longline boat that somebody's going to retain this lancet fish for, how big are they?
Oh, they can be 2 meters up to six feet. Yeah.
So they got a lot of stuff in their gullet.
They do. They have an incredible diet of stuff, and we're seeing some really interesting stuff that some pelagic octopuses and squids that we haven't seen over 20 that are sort of new to the time series.
As valuable as that, you say that you're looking at doing more. I guess, does that give you like a snapshot in time of, I mean, if you find out from, say, the longline vessel where they were about when they caught that speed, is the science that exact? I mean, can you find out?
Well, we can certainly see how the composition of prey items might change across the Pacific and in time, seasonally.
When we talk about the expansion of species, mm-hmm. let's make people understand. When most of us, when we talk about people listening to the Go Fish Show, for instance, we're looking about the four flagfish, and we're looking at the pelagics. But a lot of our divers and a lot of our whippers and dunkers, they look at the whole big picture. Mm-hmm. It's often been said, and maybe you can elaborate on that, that a fish doesn't know what grid he's in, whether he's mm-hmm. inshore, medium, or yeah. out in the deep sea. How do you differentiate the studies that you do as to what part of the planet they apply to? Mm.
Well, I mean, we look at different ecosystems. Mm-hmm. We the coral reef ecosystem, the deep, so that's mm-hmm. the thing the divers would experience and the shore right. fishermen. And then we look at the deep slope ecosystem, which is more the bottom fish habitat, and then the yeah. offshore pelagic are the three broad.
Okay, let's talk for a minute about some of the alarm that's recently gone up. I mean, as we become more, I guess, in tune with buying into or not buying into global warming. Mm-hmm. Certainly some of the things that happen in the ecosystem inshore, like in reefs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. The resilience of the ocean, to me, is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And for a scientist, it must be even more so. How can a place that was so bad return?
Yeah, so that's a positive sign mm-hmm. that the ecosystem is resilient. And it's but there's also these tipping points where mm-hmm. if you push it too far, sometimes it can turn to another state. A coral reef can become more overgrown with algae mm-hmm. if the herbivore population goes down and nutrient input or sediment input comes in. And so the challenge is to not to push it to
Jeff,
a tipping
do we,
point.
Do we sometimes, Jeff, get past that and almost in retrospect and then be in denial about what we have to do to right it?
Well,
that's what I'm worried about.
Sometimes we don't. The challenge that we have is to identify the tipping point before mm-hmm. we've crossed it, if there is such a thing. But some ecosystems seem to be fairly resilient in rebounding when you cut back the various pressures on it.
When I looked through the materials that I reviewed prior to our conversation, I saw something called Ocean Health Index. Mm-hmm. I think maybe if you can explain that, more of us would be likely to either turn something loose or not, or take the lines out of the water if the species were too small. I know that when people have demands to eat mm-hmm. or to produce an income, that these are blurred lines, but they seem to be sort of important. So maybe you can let us know what that Ocean Health Index is.
Right. So that's another approach to monitoring. One approach is to monitoring different parts of the ecosystem. This Ocean Health Index monitors the services that the ecosystem provides. Mm-hmm. So it's an approach that's been used around the globe, and we're starting to apply it here in Hawaii, where you look at the 10 different types of services that the ecosystem provides. Fisheries, tourism, recreation, coastal protection, biodiversity, clean water. There's a whole suite of these.
Sure.
And by measuring, so it's looking at evaluating an ecosystem based on the services it's providing.
That's really key. I need to interrupt only to throw this one question in there. Here's an example of that, gang. You'll notice recently we've had this decision to either limit or curtail certain things about aquarium fish on the Big Island, on the Kona Coast. And a lot of that was driven by there's a huge snorkeling mm-hmm. tourist industry, and they want to see these little fish. They don't want to see where fish used to be. Mm-hmm. So that must be the difficult part in sort of adjudicating who gets what.
Exactly. So you have to evaluate all the ways mm-hmm. the ecosystem is providing services and balance those conflicts.
Yeah, because I would imagine that if depending on who you talk to, if you talk to the Akuli guy, all mm-hmm. he cares about is nobody should be in the water here so these Akuli can grow so we can come mm-hmm. and catch them. And there's another guy says, well, I just want to take pictures. And the other guy says, well, I want to hook them. The other guy says, I want to spear them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that is, I'm guessing, that, and that's one of the reasons why the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council has all these meetings to try to parse this out.
Right, to balance these different mm-hmm. User interests and make sure that one doesn't sort of dominate or push an ecosystem into an undesirable state.
Do we have, at some points, when we have decisions, say, being made by fisheries in Washington that affect, the Pacific, that where they get their information is pretty key, and the more they get, mm-hmm. the more valid information they get, the better. I want to talk about maybe the models that mm-hmm. get generated out of the work that you do.
Okay. So we run ecosystem models mm-hmm. to try to move from just looking at a single species to the entire ecosystem. These models are still somewhat, exploratory or mm-hmm. experimental, but they allow us to evaluate you know, how different parts of the ecosystem would change if you, you know, remove fishing or if you increase fishing, how the lower trophic levels respond to that. If the climate change is reducing the productivity at the base of the food web, how that'll percolate up.
Yeah, so it's a lot more than just take or no take.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, you know, interestingly enough, at the last council meetings, when we had our Fishers Forum, and don't forget, folks, there's another one coming right up. We'll tell you about that next week. It's going to be at the Harbor View Center on Tuesday night, this next Tuesday night, a week from now. A week from when you're listening to this, and it's very, very important because that's what we're going to be discussing there is exactly what we're talking about, and that is the sharing of information. This is kind of rambling, but at the last forum, we had a couple of young gals that were doing their thesis and doing some reports, and it was about stock assessments. Mm-hmm. And isn't that a big part? You know, a stock assessment is very valuable, but all of the things you're talking about in your studies are ancillary to the stock assessment.
Right. Yeah, so that's additional information that we provide to managers. So they see sort of a single species issue, but we also try to give them a bigger picture of indicators and trends that are impacting the whole ecosystem from the composition of all of the catch to the primary productivity to the habitat. So it's a broader look.
I want to liken back to when I was a small kid, I used to spend an awful lot of time diving on the Kona Coast, and there were some places where we used to dive a lot. Mm-hmm. That your memory you remember it as this pristine place with teeming with fish and wildlife, and take what you want and leave everything else. And you go back there 40 or 50 years later and say it doesn't look the same. Part of that's true, but actually part of it's quite alarming when you see where it used to be vibrant live coral reefs, isn't it?
Right. You know? I mean, Pūako, for example, the corals have declined dramatically there. And but it seems like in that case, the residents are responding and looks like the impact is sewage from septic tanks and people are
being more
correcting
responsible.
That. Yeah.
I guess, and that's one of the reasons why in previous programs and going forward with this show, we try to talk about how important it is to be getting all of the stakeholders together to realize that, because I had a guy on a couple of months ago from the mainland, and he was talking about the Hudson River, where you couldn't see the bottom. Mm-hmm. And we did everything we possibly could to that, to New York Harbor, and it has rebounded because of stewardship.
Yeah, there's some great stories of how really damaged ecosystems have recovered when people get together and make a conscientious effort.
When given the best case scenario, outside of this ocean health index that we talked about, let's talk about the way you select the species. For instance, you said before we'd look at the apex and look at say the eye, and now we're going to look at say 10 species.
Right.
Where's the input from that come from?
Well, from the longline fishery, it comes from the observers and the logbook data, and that's a terrific data source.
Please explain, for those that don't know, how that operates, because we've talked to a lot of longline skippers and a lot of people. Some people don't like the idea, but a lot of these young people that we've had on, it's an experience, and they know they're doing some good. How valuable is that information?
The observer data is just critical. It's our only observing system that tells us something about all the high-level species in the that are being caught by the fishery. So it's our only indicator of what the top of the ecosystem is doing.
And what are some of the things that maybe as a researcher you found fascinating when this information first started coming in, when these people were novices that were out there really to make sure that there weren't too many loggerhead turtles or some other species involved, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the observer program was focused on protected species interactions.
Yeah.
But we have 2 decades of information on fish catch of all sorts of species in the longline fishery that tells us about, for example, the percent of apex or large species has declined by 50%. And as a result, though, the smaller species like pomfret and mahi and wahoo, ono, have increased by about 25% in the catch rates. So there's a top-down response. You remove a large number of these large animals, and you get an increase in the second level of animals.
Because they're not getting eaten.
Exactly.
The second level is not getting eaten by the big guys that used
There's
to be there.
There's a predation release.
But it's sooner or later, you run out of everything.
Exactly. So that's the concern. And the question is the management that's focused on a few species enough to keep the structure and the function of the ecosystem intact.
And that's where I'm guessing that the stock assessments become valuable. And the reason why I say that is because a lot of times people say, well, now they're looking at marlin. They're going to maybe limit the number of marlin you get. And then when are they going to start looking at Maimai and Ono and Ulua and all of the other species? Because it does make sense that you can't say, look, if you take all the marlin away, and the Maimai start, you can't take the Maimai out of the water fast enough to make them decrease.
Right. The Mahi are pretty resilient. But we want to maintain a structure of the ecosystem that's not too changed. So we want to look at the whole ecosystem and make sure that we don't reduce the marlins and the tunas by too large a number.
You know, one of the things we find out from different people from the council that visit us, especially from some of our neighbors throughout the rest of the Pacific, they come back with stories that where they had either almost devastated their entire economy. Mm-hmm. And that where they realize that, all right, we have to rethink this. I want to go back to the value of getting all of this stuff amalgamated. In other words, Hawaii is not the center of the universe. We're just part of it.
You know, sure.
I mean, we have these preferences, right? But we have a fleet that goes out further and further catching these things.
Right. So, I mean, we are dealing with a stock and an ecosystem that ranges very widely from, our longline fishery goes from the dateline to close to the coast of California and from the equator all the way up to,
Do you find it as fascinating as I do, Jeff, that of all of the people have to pay attention to the rules, that our longline fleet seems to be pretty well monitored more than anybody else's that I know of?
They certainly are, especially when you look at the foreign fleets that have very little management or regulation. Yeah.
They have some fishing boats that haven't been in the port for years. They don't need to go in. They get their fuel, they get their crews, they get their food, they get everybody. But in a perfect world, going forward with what you're doing at where you are at the Pacific Islands Fisheries Center, what are the big challenges? I mean, what keeps the boat floating, say?
Yeah, well, I mean, one issue is some of these indicators, what are the critical thresholds? Mm-hmm. Like if the percent of large fish have been reduced by 50% since the start of the fishery, is that a threshold? Are we getting close to some point where the ecosystem is going to be damaged? We're seeing impacts of climate change. How is that going to impact the carrying capacity of the ecosystem?
Do you find as scientists that people are more willing to embrace that there is global warming? I do know that there's a huge divide in the scientific community whether this is something that happened to the planet anyway, or is this something that we're doing? Obviously, taking fish out of the water, we're doing.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think the evidence is, so overwhelmingly positive that global warming is occurring. Mm-hmm. There'll be winners, there'll be losers, but it's human-induced.
Almost all of us are thinking about what's for dinner tonight and tomorrow rather than what's in 5 years. And in your community, you need to deal with what's going to be left if we keep going at this rate. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Are we getting anywhere? I mean, I know that greed and need make people want to throw science away, but the sooner people find out that the science is valid, what you're doing is real and not somebody just guessing, that's important.
Yeah. Well, I think managers are taking it more seriously, and they're regulating the fisheries, in a positive way.
I think that people need to understand, once again, I want to go back to our longline fleet, that these guys are pretty highly monitored and what they can and can't do. I'm still amazed, though, at maybe some of the stuff that you're doing is going to go into the decision-making process when it comes time to divide up the territories once again, and who can take what, and when one group is not catching all that their area would sustain to let somebody in and catch some more fish. It's not all about catching, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's allocation, resource allocation. And that's certainly, we provide advice about, how widely these animals might move. We leave the actual allocation to the managers.
Yeah, the reason why I said that is because we've come up with some interesting debate lately over the last couple of years here on the program and at the council meetings. Was do we have a local ahi population or not?
Yeah.
And if so, what size can we catch and what kind we can't? I feel people buying into, we are in the middle of nowhere, and probably some of these fish are our own fish, and if we take them, then we won't have them anymore.
Yeah, well, we put some electronic tags on a bunch of big eye, mostly, and they didn't, you know, over the course of a year or two, they didn't move very far.
I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, they
because didn't we in the past, Jeff, wait for, oh, well, we got to wait for the bright Japan current so we get our ahi.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, I think they're much more local than we realize or we think.
I think that one of the fears has come up, and we don't need to belabor a debate at this point, but there are a lot of people that were afraid that their panfish were going to get taken away. And what they didn't realize is that the sustenance fisherman or the guy that's a recreational fisherman is not going to be encumbered. What's going to be encumbered would be the sale of certain sizes. Mm-hmm. And that may be... Is that something that the data and statistics that you're talking about as being one of the 10 different services that would be in this big picture?
Certainly. Yeah. 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 Right.
If people want to know more about what you're doing at the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center, what can they do? I mean, they go to PIFSC, NOAA, Gov, et cetera.
Sure, and then they go to ecosystems, mm-hmm. and we also have a database of all of our satellite data if they want to look at some of that. That's all on the website.
For those who don't know, where's the bricks and mortar? Where's your building?
We're out on Ford Island, mm-hmm. Brand-new building. Yeah. We've been there about a year. We used to be up by the university, and so we have a great new building. The ships are out there. The labs are brand-new.
I think it's a great validation of the value that we're getting. When I say we, the taxpayer and the citizen, the value we're getting for the buck, it means that the science is real and it's being embraced. And I think that that's probably key. Isn't that why we do things like this, to let people know that, hey, we're panicking, but we're not going to say woe is me and alas, we got to stop fishing.
Right, exactly, Mike. And of course, that whole building is a testament to the late Senator Dan Inouye,
that's
who
great.
Put that.
You know, the self-proclaimed king of pork, he called himself. But boy, oh boy.
We've benefited.
We certainly have. Hey, Jeff, I want to thank you very much for joining me today and continued success, and hopefully we can see each other again sometime.
Thanks, Mike.
That's Dr. Jeff Pulavina. He's a PhD. He's a senior scientist and chief ecosystems and oceanography division guy at the Pacific Island Fisheries Science Center. If you put that all in one business card, it's going to go around the block a couple times. Hey, thanks for being here. We'll be back again next week with another program. In the meantime, if you want to hear something, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@aol.com. themikebuckshow@aol.com. And remember, fishing is a privilege, not just a right sometimes. And we got to share and share alike. So for everybody here at KHNR, The Answer, and the Pacific Island Fisheries Management Group, and the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, POP Fishing and Marine, NECOS, and Life Raft and Marine Safety. Have a great rest of the weekend. We'll see you next time. Aloha.